against the nature of life in the West, against the dominant doctrines of our culture, overcome them to make that ultimate surrender, which is the key to Islam.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In recent years, gun violence in America has been one of the most critical challenges facing society. According to a recent analysis, gun-related deaths are the leading cause of death for American children and adolescents. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website of AlertNet writes, the number of children shot and killed in the United States in 2022 exceeded 6,000. The Gun Violence Archive found that at least 6,032 children 17 years of age or younger had been the victims of America's deadly gun epidemic. That was the highest fatality rate since the Gun Violence Archive started keeping a record of gun violence casualties in 2014. The figure reflected a notable increase since last year, when arbitrary deployment of firearms by civilians was found to be responsible for around 5,700 casualties across the country. At least 306 children, 11 years old or younger, have been killed by gunfire, with 668 being injured. Additionally, 1,325 teenagers aged between 12 and 17 died by gunfire, with 3,732 being injured. Recently, the Gun Violence Archive said there had been a total of 609 mass shootings in 2022 in the United States. It is projected to reach around 675 by the end of this year. The grim statistics come after a 3-year-old girl in Kansas City, Missouri, was killed on Christmas Eve in what police suspect was an accidental shooting. The child shooting deaths in 2022 also include 19 students, all 11 years old or younger, killed in a mass shooting on 24th of May at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. One of the youngest victims killed by gunfire this year was a 5-month-old baby who was shot in the head while sitting in a car in Chicago, Illinois, during a 24th of June drive-by shooting incident. The United States has been suffering from an expanding trend of gun violence and episodes of mass shootings. In July, President Joe Biden admitted that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields. In October, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, released data on U.S. firearm deaths last year, counting over 47,000, which is the most in at least 40 years. The U.S. population is growing, but researchers say the rate of gun deaths has been getting worse. America's gun-related homicide and suicide rates both rose 8% last year, hitting unprecedented levels since the early 1990s. The New York Times has also covered the story. The gun death rate for children is nearly 5 in every 100,000. It was flat for more than a decade starting in 2000, and most years fewer than 3 in every 100,000 children were killed by guns. In 2014, the rate began to creep up, and by 2020, guns became the leading killer of American children. According to provisional statistics from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, last year was a particularly violent year. 3,597 children died by gunfire. The death rate from guns was the highest it has been in more than 20 years. While the statistics for this year are incomplete, it is clear that the carnage has not receded. In May of this year, the nation watched as horror unfolded in Uvalde, Texas. Yet another school ripped apart by bullets. Yet another group of children to mourn. Yet another shooting in a long line of school shootings. And though the number of school shootings has recently risen to the highest level on record, the overall picture is so much worse. These shootings account for less than 1% of the total gun deaths suffered by American children. No group of American children has been spared, but some have fared worse than others. Last year, nearly two-thirds of gun deaths involved children, 2,279 were homicides. Since 2018, they have increased by more than 73%. Most homicides involve black children, who make up a small share of all children, but shoulder the burden of gun violence more than any others, a disparity that is growing sharply. The number of children who die by suicide with a gun has also risen to a historical high over the last decade. Last year, suicides made up nearly 30% of child gun deaths, 1,078. Unlike homicides, suicides disproportionately involve white children, mostly teenage boys. A decade ago, the number of white children who killed themselves with a gun totaled around 500 annually. In three of the last 5 years, the figure has surpassed 700. The share of gun suicides for black and Hispanic children has been growing as well. Still, in America, among children who die by gunfire, black and Hispanic children are more likely to be killed by others, and white children are more likely to kill themselves. Gun accidents that kill children have also ticked up in the last decade, though they are relatively uncommon, totaling fewer than 150 in most years. Researchers who study gun violence say that is difficult to explain exactly why gun deaths among children have risen so quickly, but most emphasize that the increased availability of guns, especially handguns, which tend to be used in homicides and suicides, and also tend to be stored less safely than some other types of guns, has most likely played a role. The website of Kaiser Family Foundation has also covered the same story. Firearm injuries and deaths in the United States have increased in recent years and adversely affect many children and adolescents. In 2020, firearms became the leading cause of death among children aged 19 and below, and in the first 6 months of 2022, there were over 300 mass shootings across the United States, including the shooting at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. In addition to physical harm, direct and indirect exposure to gun violence can never negatively affect the mental health and well-being of young people. During the pandemic, firearm-related deaths increased among children, with 7 children per day dying of firearms in 2021. From 2011 to 2021, nearly 18,500 children aged 17 and younger died by firearm. During this period, firearm death rates gradually rose until 2017, then slowed through 2019 before sharply rising in the first 2 years of the pandemic. From 2019 to 2021, The firearm death rate among children increased by 50%. This translates to 7 children per day dying by firearm in 2021. Throughout the past decade, assaults have accounted for at least half of all youth firearm deaths, while suicides by firearm have accounted for at least 3 in 10 of these deaths. The spike in youth firearm deaths during the pandemic have primarily been driven by gun assaults. Firearm-related injuries among children have also increased in recent years from 9.9 per 100,000 population in 2010 to 15.5 per 100,000 population in 2020. Superheroes and Beyond. Part 2.
In a hot night in the summer in the late 1930s, a teenage boy who had recently lost his father in a street fight saw a superhuman character in his dream who had replaced his father. Strong, smart, fast, and protector of security. A superhero that the crisis-stricken American society anxiously waited for so he'd rescue them from the economic problems and injustice of the 1930s.
Fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
Not many people thought that the dream of a teenager would be so influential and leave such a huge impact on the future of a country. The Americans of the 1930s were challenged with social and economic problems, injustice, and crime. They needed a source of power who could put an end to their crises. A superhuman solution should have been found for the problems apparently no human being could solve. That was how Superman, the first superhero of comic stories, became the solution to the crisis. It was a DC company that released the red and blue clad man stories for the first time and started the narratives of a superhero. Superman fought against injustice in American society, corrupt officials and gangsters, and supported the oppressed and miserable people. Every day, American weapons would stoke tensions in the war in Europe, and the U.S. in return would rip a huge economic benefit from selling weapons to the country involved in the war. Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in the United States served as an excuse to push the public to support Washington's engagement in the war. At that time, Captain America was quite helpful in setting the stage for the U.S. to get involved in the war. All American superheroes fought alongside the U.S. Army against the villain forces who had threatened America. In a period of 20 years after propagating American values, about 78 million children were born during the baby boom. That generation always felt the shadow of a nuclear war. The baby boom generation had become teens who started their activities to take part in society and express their demands. They needed new heroes to shout their demands out loud. As a generation grew up, the crime rates among the youth during the 60s rose. They lived during an economic boost and would never understand their father's concerns. It was like that generation and their parents were born in two different countries and were in two different worlds. They voted for Kennedy as a young and handsome president. They loved the Beatles and gradually started hippie bands.
That's why these children are practicing to...
Hulk, a character who turns into a green monster due to atomic radiation. As he was repelled by society, he turned into a popular hero for the baby boom generation who felt alienated from their own identities. Marvel's other nuclear hero, and the most popular one during the period, was Spider-Man. Peter Parker, an introvert, thin teenage boy who was from a baby boom generation, turned into a hero with amazing powers after he was bitten by a nuclear radiation-infected spider. Marvel introduced other heroes like Ant-Man, Thor, Iron Man, and X-Men with the same principles. Marvel's new heroes were nervous, complicated characters with a list of deficiencies whose human aspects were magnified and were distinguished from the flawless characters before. The baby boom generation changed society. Following social injustices, the Vietnam War, racism, and the assassination of their popular president, Kennedy, the generation triggered a social revolution and questioned American values and causes. During those years, the Cold War reached its pinnacle. The Soviet influence in Vietnam increased, and the U.S. did not want to lag behind the rivalry. People in the U.S. took to the streets to protest the Vietnam War. But the most important superhero in the hero-making industry in the U.S., concurrent with the Vietnam War, was Iron Man, whose real name was Tony Stark. The Vietnam War, with its huge casualties and costs, was one of the shameful decisions in the eyes of Americans, and the opposition had snowballed. Society needed to be convinced. Someone had to sympathize with the people who had lost their sons and daughters. It was Iron Man who was tasked to do so. In the 1960s, he initially supported the U.S. Army's involvement in the Vietnam War, arguing that the U.S. will make a lot of money selling weapons. But gradually, he faced many changes. Increasingly disillusioned with U.S. foreign policy, in the mid-1970s, he expressed remorse for the deaths of people who were killed by the weapons that he made and said he will take revenge for the people who lost their lives, especially for ignorant people like himself.
I saw young Americans killed by the very weapons I created to defend them and protect them. And I saw that I had become part of a system that is comfortable with zero accountability.
What happened over there?
I had my eyes open. I came to realize that I have more to offer this world than just making things to blow up. And that is why, effective immediately, I am shutting down the weapons manufacturer division.
The change in his character was a symbol of change in American society that had become aware of its own identity. The enemies of the superheroes were no longer the Germans, Japanese, communists, or any other foreign entity. The main enemy was inside the United States. During this period, the protests by people of color against racial discrimination spread. Leaders like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. turned into the symbols of resistance against the U.S. structure. The protests were at their highest after the assassination of Malcolm X in 1965. The incidents made Marvel create its first black character named the Black Panther. The scandal caused by President Richard Nixon, his resignation, and high inflation and unemployment rates made things worse.
In Washington, a break-in at the Watergate Hotel was found to involve five men in the pay of the committee to re-elect President Nixon. The burglar's target was the office of the chairman of the Democratic Party. The story was to make the names of two young local reporters from the Washington Post.
The catastrophe following Nixon's corruption case and the Watergate scandal gripped American rulers by the collar. They had realized that public opinion needed to calm down. And just like in the past, the superheroes were the best options. In one of the comic stories in this period, Captain America, with his fake copy, namely, the Captain America in the 1950s, who fought for the U.S. Army, tells himself, "I've never fought with my own demonic part. A man with patriotic dreams, I'm responsible for the evil he did." Captain America was fighting with a sinister empire that wanted to take control of the U.S. In the end, he captured head of the White House, and by removing his mask, he realized the U.S. president was the head of the evil group. The story is about the disgraced Nixon administration. This time, unlike the previous times, the captain didn't become happy after achieving victory, and he abandons the fight. He loses faith in Americans and chooses to become a stateless man. He says, "I've done things that I don't take pride in anymore, but I always tried to serve my country well. Now I can see that the government is serving itself." The bitter taste of those days made Spider-Man stories bitter. Something rare happened in Spider-Man. Mary Jane, Spider-Man's fiancée, was killed in a fight. Spider-Man blamed himself for Mary Jane's death and never stopped reprimanding himself following the incident. It was similar to how Americans felt about their government. Marvel adopted this line and made social criticism in its stories. DC also tried to become aligned with social developments to some extent. So, it introduced a real hero against the power structure in America in its stories. He was the greatest and the eternal boxer, Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali won the Olympic gold medal at the age of 20. He was always against the government because of the oppression against the black community. And because of his stance, he didn't join the army so he wouldn't be forced to fight for the U.S. Army in Vietnam. Muhammad Ali was a symbol of resistance against U.S. dominance, and he had become an international figure. And DC used the popular hero. In one of the stories, Superman, who's a symbol of America, was defeated by Muhammad Ali in a boxing bout. Later, they made up a team to save the planet from aliens. In the end, Muhammad Ali wins in a boxing competition against the aliens, and Earth was saved. The pictorial story became the best-selling comic in the late 1970s. After Ronald Reagan took office in the 1980s, he made the government smaller but expanded the army. The conflict with the Soviets escalated, and American citizens' nationalistic support boosted thanks to professional media techniques. Reagan, who was formerly a movie star, knew very well how to act like a hero. Amid the Soviet threats and the Cold War, many people were scared of widespread crime. The Reagan administration was an avid proponent of individualism and consumerism, while the population was more scared of the violence. In Night of Darkness, there's a character of the president in the city of Gotham. It shows a cartoon of Reagan and his nationalistic speech.
Brave American forces are now engaged in direct combat with Soviet troops in Corto Maltese. Now those Soviets would like to see us turn our tails and run, but we've got to protect our interest, stand up for freedom. So don't you fret, we've got God on our side. Or the next best thing, anyway.
The city was about to collapse because of injustice. In the real world, on December 22, 1984, a citizen from New York named Bernard Goetz shot thieves with 4 bullets to defend himself. People sympathized with him, and the court that had already indicted Goetz acquitted him. He became the symbol of a person who has provided security and safety for himself
in a chaotic world. He saved himself through his acts of violence. The situation provided comic books with sufficient ammo, and new characters stepped in. In response to the world of violence, three characters, namely Punisher, Daredevil, and Logan, torture their enemies through the most violent methods and would kill them after they lost a lot of blood.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Islamic Revolution and Economic Achievements. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In order to have a proper picture of the economic achievements of the Islamic Revolution, we should have a look at the waning days of the Pahlavi rule in Iran. During the Shah regime, Iran's economy was excessively dependent on oil exports. Millions of oil barrels were exported every day, while a huge amount of consumer goods worth hundreds of millions of dollars were imported to the country. During the last decade of the Shah reign, oil price enjoyed an unprecedented rise so that in 1977, the oil revenues reached over 20 billion of dollars, whereas this number never amounted to $1 billion in the decade before. American writer Francis Fitzgerald wrote that the Shah did not make serious effort for the development of the country. The country's wealth had been funneled mostly toward personal cars rather than buses, consumer goods rather than public health, and the salaries of soldiers and police rather than teachers. It can be said on the economy of 1970s in Iran that the regime's programs destroyed the economic balance of the country due to being far from the realities of society. As the Iranian economy was highly dependent on oil, the 1976-78 reduction of oil prices caused the government to borrow money, which in turn resulted in a bunch of problems, such as the shortage of skillful manpower. shortage of communicative networks like roads and ports, shortage of electricity, escape of capitals from the country, inflation, unemployment, housing, and so on. Unjust distribution of income in rural and urban regions and different strata of people caused remarkable class gap in society. Andrew Duncan, author of the book Looting Iran, Assault Towards Money, says that Iran's economy highly suffered from the ambitious and unwise plans of the Shah and his lack of information in the Iranian society. He writes that the Shah thought that money can solve every problem. He summoned the members of his cabinet on one day in August 1974 and announced that he wanted to double the 1973-78 development program. It meant to increase it from $35.5 billion to $86.8 billion. Although there were few specialists to implement such a huge plan, it would make no difference for the Shah. He would announce, for instance, that all children should go to school while forgetting that it needed at least 30,000 teachers. The Shah Prime Minister Hoveyda said in response to this great shortage, "No problem, we will teach all via TV." He had forgotten that over 65,000 villagers had no power grid at all. The victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in February 1979 revived hopes in the hearts of people. In spite of unprecedented pressures of enemies to obstruct or at least slow down the move of the revolution towards lofty ideals, including the 8-year imposed war, innumerable conspiracies inside and outside the country, and also imposition of the cruelest illegal sanctions on every aspect of the country's economy, the Islamic Republic has marched proudly in the course of growth and development. Justice enjoys a very outstanding position in Islam. According to the Quran, the aim of mission of all prophets has been to establish justice in society. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that cities and countries will not be developed except by justice. In view of this, among the most important goals of the officials in three branches of governance has been to provide welfare for people and provide them justice in various economic fields. Before the revolution, few villages enjoyed electricity, hygiene, water, natural gas, and telephone. This was common even among small cities and towns. Less than 12% of the rural areas had access to water grid, while this figure has surpassed 82%. There was 0 kilometer of water transferring line before the revolution, whereas the figure has reached almost 31 kilometers after the revolution. Qadir project in Khuzestan province has recently been exploited. The project is said to be the greatest in West Asia, and it will transfer drinking water to 26 cities and over 1,600 villages. The project has been implemented by Khatamul Anbiya Construction Base, whose young experts have managed to finish the project within 8 months, while it was predicted to end in 36 months. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been successful in the field of dam construction. The number of dams in the country has increased tenfold compared with the pre-revolution era. In other words, nearly 200 dams have been built in Iran by a skillful young specialist. Dams are useful in various domains, including the production of hydroelectric energy. Iran is among the 10 top nations in the construction of power plants. This has caused 100% of the population in the cities and approximately 99.6% of the rural people to enjoy electricity. This, while the average electricity access among villages and cities in the world is 79 and 96% respectively. Another success in Iran in the field of energy is the construction of petrochemical factories and refineries. Over 70% of Iran's energy consumption relies on natural gas. Currently, more than 98% of cities and 84% of villages are connected to the natural gas grid. There are nearly 2,000 active oil companies in the country. Before the revolution, the major part of this industry was run by foreign firms. But today, Iranian experts have succeeded to indigenize 80% of the equipment needed in the field. The great bulk of this equipment is high-tech. 50 of the manufacturing companies are in the international rank and export some of their products, like catalysts, to Russia. Iran seriously tries to increase the number of petrochemical factories and refineries to prevent crude sale. Today, the number of active petrochemical complexes has increased to 68, more than tenfold the period before the revolution. Between 90 to 100 million liters of gasoline is averagely produced every day in the country. This includes 27% of Iran's refinery basket, which is higher than the global average.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Dutch Prime Minister recently apologized for his country's colonial past and the enslavement mandated by the Dutch state from the 17th to 19th century. Now, in his remarks, which were met with cynicism, he said that slavery must be recognized in the clearest terms as a crime against humanity. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the so-called apology by the government of the Netherlands over the country's role in slavery and the slave trade. Many are skeptical of the apology and are demanding full reparations to the descendants of slaves. In the second part of our program today, we are discussing the historical move by Zimbabwe to ban the exports of unprocessed lithium ore in a move aimed at encouraging value addition. So stay with us as our experts give us their insight on today's subjects.
Africa needs reparations for slavery. Last December, the Dutch Prime Minister officially apologized for 250 years of the Netherlands' involvement in slavery. The apology comes almost 150 years after the end of slavery in the European countries' overseas colonies. The current wealth of the Dutch was accumulated through the evil transatlantic slave trade. This European power is believed to have shipped over 600,000 Africans as part of the slave trade, mostly to South America and the Caribbean. In Asia, at least 1 million people were traded in areas under the Dutch East India Company.
The Prime Minister of St. Martin, an autonomous state within the Kingdom of the Netherlands in the Caribbean, is skeptical of the apology. She says her state will not accept nor deny apologies for the slavery from the Dutch government.
In our many discussions since September 6th, when the first meeting was forced to hear us, It was explained that this is not the way from our side, that this is not the way to properly dialogue on a topic of such enormous proportions. Repeatedly, this sentiment has been conveyed that it is in poor taste to move full steam ahead with an apology before proper dialogue has taken place, without proper respect for the feelings of the people who you want to apologize to, the descendants of those who endured, as was mentioned here today, the most devastating crime against humanity.
Well, for more on the so-called apology by the Netherlands over its slave trade crimes, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why has the Netherlands decided to apologize for engaging in the evil slave trade at this point in time?
It was a response to a report published by a government-appointed advisory board. That board had recommendations, including the government's apology and recognition that the slave trade and slavery from the 17th century until abolition were crimes against humanity. And the report said that what it called institutional racism in the Netherlands can't be separated from centuries of slavery and colonialism and the ideas that arose in that context. Also, that apology comes at a time when countries' brutal colonial histories have received critical scrutiny because of the police killing of George Floyd in the U.S. In May 2020 and the movement that was birthed in the aftermath of his death.
African academics and ancestors of slaves say Western countries that were involved in the slave trade and other colonial-era crimes should not only offer apologies, but also pay reparations to affected countries.
Yes, they should absolutely pay reparations. The loss of human life from the African continent and diaspora due to the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism had a real cost. Africa and African people weren't just deprived of lost manpower and income, but also creativity, innovation, and relationships. And, you know, those losses were multiplied by millions of lives over hundreds of years, which really stunted their development.
The Prime Minister of Sint Maarten says financial aid should not be conceived as reparations.
That financial aid and loans provided thus far by the Netherlands can and should never be conceived of as part of reparations owed as a result of the expected apology.
The Netherlands says it is offering only a 200 million euro fund for initiatives to help address the legacy of slavery, insisting that it will not pay reparations. Now, what's your take on this decision?
Well, I think we should look at the case of Suriname, the small South American country where Dutch plantation owners generated huge profits through the use of enslaved labor. In Suriname, the largest opposition party, the NDP, condemned the Dutch government for failing to adequately consult descendants of enslaved people in the country. And, you know, what we understand is, you know, what's really needed is compensation, right? It's not just this apology. If you chalk up the billions of hours that enslaved Africans worked on Dutch plantations and pay that at a living wage, and you tally up the compensation of the millions of souls that were sacrificed to famine as a result of Dutch colonization.
The Netherlands usually celebrates Christmas with a controversial blackface figure accompanying Saint Nicholas, and many people consider it deeply offensive and a legacy of racism in this European country. Activists say this is a form of racial stereotyping and institutional racism prevalent in the Netherlands.
It's more than Swart Piet. It's about power, you know, and who get to decide who is Dutch or not, who get to decide whether we're going to uphold a racist tradition or not, and who get to decide what is racism or not. So we are talking about identity also. We are talking about slavery has manifested into our souls as today, how we behave towards one another.
The apology by the Netherlands Prime Minister came after a report found that people within the Dutch Foreign Ministry had been exposed to racist comments, and some were even passed over for promotion due to their skin color or ethnic origin. With such reports, is the apology in itself seen as an act of hypocrisy?
Absolutely. The apology is definitely an act of hypocrisy when these states, like the Netherlands, refuse to make any material impact or change as, acknowledging that they've done wrong along with that. As Frantz Fanon once wrote, right, the wealth of imperialist countries or nations is our wealth. You know, Europe is literally the creation of the third world. So, you know, if we understand that colonialism built Europe's wealth, then total repayment would mean giving it up and changing these conditions that allow for, you know, racist comments, you know, the passing over for promotion and other, impacts or effects of racist ideologies. And so, I mean, as I think as long as, there is a gap in wealth between, you know, the colonizing European countries and the colonized countries in the global South, in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, you know, these apologies, like what the Netherlands did recently, will be acts of hypocrisy.
Some African academics say that no material compensation can ever be enough for crimes of slavery, apartheid, or genocide. So it's better to accept apologies and move on.
You know, slave traders had no trouble pricing a human life, and abolition-era economists repaid slave owners for the losses of their freed slaves. It seems that it's only when the descendants of those slaves, those negatively impacted by colonialism, only when they return to ask for compensation does counting become difficult. When they're trying to receive some sort of, compensation for their lost ancestors, that's only when things become difficult. But I don't think that's where we should stop. We should press on and push until we win those full, honest, and courageous reparations that we deserve as colonized people.
Last year, a 4-day summit on the theme Advancing Justice, Reparations, and Racial Healing was held in Accra, Ghana. Speaking during the summit, President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana said reparations for Africa and the African diaspora are long overdue.
We believe the calls for reparations to Africa are just. The effects of the slave trade have been devastating to the continent and to the African diaspora. You cannot quantify the effects of such tragedies, but they need to be recognized. Africa and her peoples lost out tremendously in that period, and its ripple effects are still being felt right till this very day.
The movement for reparations to countries and descendants of slavery has been gaining momentum over the recent years. Now, what needs to be done to compel European powers to start gradual reparations?
A powerful movement for reparations for centuries of slavery and colonialism, that movement needs to be built. And, you know, movement building is difficult work. It takes being in the streets with the people, developing real relationships and building unity around, these issues, as well as a joint plan of action. And so, you know, that movement building work hasn't really taken off. I think there needs to be more effort and attention placed on that movement building work. It has to connect, you know, Africa and the diaspora to create like a worldwide crusade for reparations for the African and Black world as a whole. And so I think if we want you know, these European powers to take us seriously, to, you know, actually start with reparative justice. You know, what it takes is the building of a transnational reparations movement that's strong and has some leverage.
Well, there you have it. Our analyst there says that Africans and people of African descent should unite and create a transnational reparations movement to compel European powers to pay for their crimes. I'd like to thank Tunde Osazua for his incisive analysis today. And we now take a short break before our next topic on the historic move by Zimbabwe to ban the export of raw lithium so that it can cash in on value addition. Stay with us.
Zimbabwe stops lithium plunder.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Zimbabwe has banned the export of raw lithium with immediate effect. The Southern Africa country has the largest lithium reserve in Africa, but European and North American companies and smugglers have been extracting the valuable ore without paying their dues.
The growing global demand for electric vehicles and renewable energy has seen Chinese companies investing in lithium mining in recent years. A Chinese firm has purchased a lithium mine near Harare, a move that authorities in Zimbabwe believe will halt the plundering of this country's lithium by Western multinationals.
Speaking during the commissioning of the lithium processing plant in Bikita, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said that such value addition projects will have win-win benefits for all. Well, to discuss Zimbabwe's historic move to ban the exportation of unprocessed lithium, we have contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist. Now, what will be the impact of Zimbabwe's decision to ban the export of raw lithium ore?
Which is good. Zimbabwe is looking at harnessing the value from lithium to be able to empower its industrialization, to be able to empower its energy needs. And this is in line with the African mining vision aspirations. The African mining vision looks at enriching minerals within Africa, contribute to structural transformation of African economies. So Zimbabwe, by doing that, is actually just implementing the aspirations of the African mining vision. And it's very good. Again, the consequence is that Zimbabwe is now showing a story, telling the reality that yes, it can work and be able to end the continued dependence of the global West, of the West and North America and Europe on Africa for raw materials.
The European Union and the U.S. have been exploiting Africa's lithium mines and leaving African countries poorer. It is expected that Western powers will resist Zimbabwe's move, like they reacted to a similar move by Indonesia, claiming it breaches international trade rules.
So yes, I for a